So, as you can see, it was a wonderful feast. I hope it was wonderful for you, but it wasn't without its challenges. And I think we're all fully aware in this world today that we all are going to face challenges and difficulties. But we returned home yesterday, safe and sound, uneventful trip back home, probably a few pounds heavier. That's why I also hate this lectern. But with a lot of memories and a lot of stories to tell from this year's Feast of Tabernacles. I'd like to ask you a very simple question. First of all, we're going to pretend we're still at the feast. I don't want to come home yet. I explained to the brethren in Estes Park that I have a hate-love relationship with the last great day. You know, I love the meaning of the day. It's wonderful. It's exciting. But boy, I hate that last day when it comes to having to go home and everything just sort of shuts down and everybody's leaving and you're saying goodbye. And I always dreaded that. I've told people as well, the worst day of my life was always the first day back at school after being at the feast for as a teenager, because it just was not the same. And it would take a while to finally get into the same bad attitude you were at school before. You're the only one smiling when you walk into school, and you've just come back from the feast, and you're all happy, and suddenly you realize that's not the way it used to be, and it's not the way it is at school. And so a few days later, you're back in the same bad attitude as everybody else. But so we're going to pretend today we're still at the Feast of Tabernacles, if you don't mind. And I have a simple question for you. What did you bring back from the feast with you this year? What did you bring back? What did you learn from this year's Feast of Tabernacles? You know, human beings learn things on a basic timetable or time scale based on age. It's been documented that your brain development reaches 85% by the age of 5. Now, it's not that you've learned 85% of everything you're going to learn, but that your capacity for learning at the age of 5 is already at 85% of what it will ever be. And so, again, it's sort of a time scale. It's been also, in other words, as I said, 85% of your potential is achieved. Babies learn to talk at a few months. They learn to walk around a year or less. By the age of 4, a child speaks in sentences of 5 or 6 words, begins to tell stories, and is capable of following 3-part commands. I'm not sure our children ever could, but anyway, that was they're supposed to be able to follow 3-part commands by the age of 5 or 6. By age 5, though, they begin to show increased independence, can count to 10 or more objects, and correctly name at least 4 colors. They speak in sentences of more than 5 words, and they tell longer stories. But learning doesn't end at age 5, nor should it. Mahatma Gandhi once said, "Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever." That learning goes on forever. We must never stop learning. In the book, in a book called A History of Knowledge, Past, Present, and Future by Charles Van Doren, written in 1991, he wrote this: "Just as in our individual lives we learn more and more from day to day and from year to year because we remember some at least of what we have learned and add our knowledge to it, so in the history of the race, the collective memory retains at least some knowledge from the past to which is added every new discovery." In other words, knowledge is something that accumulates, but it requires that we add to that knowledge and that we remember what we have already learned. So a good example would be the story of flight. The Wright brothers did not begin by developing a jet engine. You know, that's not where they began. But they began by building on the knowledge when they first, the first flight for the Wright brothers, the study of flight and even several well-known disasters had occurred and had been going on for 30 years. And so they built upon the knowledge that had already been there, and they, of course, developed the airplane. Certainly, they're ones given credit for developing the airplane. Knowledge accumulates. You gain more each year. The feast is not a one-time event. The feast is intended for you to gain knowledge and to add to that knowledge as time, of course, goes on. Knowledge has exploded in our day, partly because of the accumulated knowledge of decades past. We learn, then add to the knowledge in subsequent years. Knowledge and the ability to learn spiritual lessons is what separates man from animal. That's not the only thing, but it certainly separates man from animal. Animals cannot conceive spiritual principles, nor can they learn or accumulate knowledge of spiritual things. But you can. In fact, you should, as we know from year to year. And this is true in civilizations. Consider that this is also a part of the book, The History of Knowledge, in which the author says that if you think back or if you follow history, there were two great civilizations in the Americas, one in Central America and one in South America, the Incas and the Aztecs, who were far advanced. Far advanced. And yet the Spaniards came in and conquered them easily. And this author contends that was because these civilizations, the Incas and the Aztecs, controlled knowledge among a few elite. They didn't share that with the others, and they were very poor, were not educated, and they were mistreated. They had child sacrifices. They had all of these things put upon them by the leadership or the rulers of the Incas and the Aztecs. So when the Spaniards came, even though they were also cruel, there wasn't a lot of incentive to fight for the ruling class that you actually despised and was controlled by keeping back knowledge. So the Spaniards easily conquered the Aztecs and the Incas. And that's always been a marvel of history because they were so far developed as far as their ability to build things and do things. And they had knowledge, but they didn't share knowledge. You think of the church today, you think of the Feast of Tabernacles, is where we all go to do what? To share knowledge. You know, it's not a matter of holding on to knowledge. It's a matter of sharing knowledge and our accumulating knowledge. You know, your first 5 years in the church were probably pretty, maybe difficult. I'm sure exciting. You had a lot of excitement and enthusiasm because you were learning something all the time. As I've said before, we began attending services in Memphis, Tennessee. We received a letter from Mr. Armstrong in July of 1961 announcing the opening of a congregation in Memphis, Tennessee. The old Ellis Auditorium that is called Cook Auditorium today sits on the Mississippi River, and we met in a room in the basement of that building. And we were very excited because we had not had a congregation before. And then we were so excited, we thought, this is great. Mr. Armstrong is coming just to see us. We couldn't imagine there was anybody else in the church in the whole state of Arkansas. We'd never heard of anybody else. And so we showed up at services, and there were 70 or so people there. And in fact, and I've mentioned this before, one of the individuals there was a distant cousin or relative of my mother, and we didn't know anything about him. We didn't know he was interested in this. He was a baptized member. My mother had been considered a member since 1952, and he had heard stories about this strange person, my mother, and we'd heard stories about these strange relatives, him, and how they did all these strange things. And yet we showed up and we found out they were following the same thing we were. And we didn't know that until we attended services. But I remember every Sabbath in those years, we would have a service, and then after services were at 3 o'clock, finished maybe at 5, maybe at 6, depended on who was there. And then we would have a break. We'd go out and get a meal, go out and get a hamburger, whatever. And then we would come back and have either a Bible study one Saturday night and a spokesman club the next Saturday night. And even as a child sitting there, I was thinking, how did they get so smart? They answered all the questions. And this was amazing to me, and you couldn't learn enough. And so those first 5 years or so in church were just amazing because you were learning and you were adding to your knowledge. Sadly, I think it's somewhere along the line, and I'm not speaking specifically because I don't know specific examples, I think we may have stopped adding to that knowledge. Maybe we stopped growing like we did those first few years in the church. Again, I'm not suggesting it's the same. As we become more mature, things happen a little differently. It's not the same as when you first came in. And I'm not suggesting it could ever be exactly the same. The Feast of Tabernacles, though, is an example of learning. It's an example of sort of an experiment, sort of a laboratory. And we learn from hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling. We experience the feast. We don't just look at the feast. We experience the feast. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing that we've all done, experience the feast. Benjamin Franklin once wrote this. He says, "Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember. Involve me and I learn." The Feast of Tabernacles is unique in involving all of us in something very, very special. There's nothing like it anywhere. When, of course, many of us were in the Worldwide Church of God, we would advertise, and I, as far as I know, it was true, that we were the largest convention, as they would call it, on the face of the earth. And they figure that by the number of days. In other words, it's not just the attendance. So if you have 5,000 people for 8 days, that comes out to 40,000. So, or 40,000 room nights, as it would be considered. So when you added all the 150,000 or so that attended the feast, and then you multiply that times 8, it made us the largest convention or meeting on earth. You know, it was unique. There was nothing else like it. When we met in the tent in Big Sandy, Texas, which some of you probably did, we certainly did. We met first in the old metal tabernacle, which became the field house for Ambassador College, and then we met in a tent before they built another convention center. 12,000 or 15,000 people, whatever it was, in a tent, and we were told, and again, I don't have any reason to doubt it, that was the largest tent in the world. They had to make that tent specially for us. So it was something unique. It wasn't something common. It wasn't something you did every 2 or 3 months. Once a year, you attended the Feast of Tabernacles, and you learned. Next year you added to that, the next year you added to that, until today, hopefully from this feast, we've added something as well. This was my 55th feast to attend, but we began keeping the feast in the 1950s, which would be 60 years to observe, or somewhere thereabouts, but 55 years to actually attend the feast. How much knowledge should you have gained in 55 years? I'm sure a lot more than I've gained. I also, in the first message that I gave during the feast, spoke a little bit about the history. This year, 2017, marks the 90th year, the 90th anniversary since Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong began keeping the holy days, just the two of them. So we have a consistent history now of 90 years of a body of people, all the way from a few score, or actually less than that, when Mr. Armstrong began, 21 of them, when they began, it was he and his wife, but later 21, then it went to 30, then it went to 35, then it went to 40, it went to 45, went to 50, to 60, these were each year going by, but in 1945, when Mr. Armstrong made a decision, because when he read the Bible carefully, he saw very clearly that the feast was a commanded assembly in which you were to go somewhere. And that was a big shock to the people in Eugene, Oregon. Because you see, the way they'd kept the feast before was they kept the two holy days at a small church building. They kept the two holy days. They had a Bible study in the evening, but they all went to work during the day, during the regular days of the feast. And they'd done that for more than a dozen years. So 1 year for Mr. Armstrong to announce, well, no, we're going to do it different now. We're going to a place called Belknap Springs in eastern Oregon, I believe. And we're going to be there for the full 8 days. It was a shock. And a large percentage of the people just said no. And so the church went from 60 people back down to 45 people. It's one of the few years that there was actually a drop during the days of Radio Church of God and Worldwide Church of God. Because people thought, well, we can't do that. We can't leave our jobs. We can't leave our families. We can't go off to this place to keep the feast. We'll keep the holy days, but we're not going to do that. Mr. Armstrong was convinced it was commanded. It wasn't a matter of choice, the way he read the scripture. And in spite of the fact that it wasn't going to be easy, he said, you know, we really need to do this. And he did. And those 45 or so, I believe it was 45 that year, also kept the feast. Remarkable story. of commitment and conviction about something that was so unique. You don't find anything like it in the religious world. You know, there'll be festivals, there'll be celebrations, but to pack up and go someplace for 8 days is unheard of. Yet you and I speak for myself, grew up knowing that information. I began with that knowledge. I didn't have to go out and find it for myself. I began with that knowledge. So 55 years later, I can look back and say, well, you know, I can't remember every feast, where I was or what I did. I could tell you certain ones. I told the story in Estes Park about my feast in 1965. I remember it just very, very clearly. A few embarrassing things happened to me during that feast as a 15-year-old that I remember very clearly. I remember learning some things as well when Mr. Armstrong gave the message on the last great day. And either I was not as in tune before or he just said it differently, but it really became reality to me. 1965, I remember that very, very clearly, sitting in the tent in Big Sandy, Texas. There have been some extraordinary feasts in the course of my lifetime, 55 years, some that were just absolutely so incredible. I remember the very first feast and how incredible it was. And I've said it before, it was so loud in that metal building when you walked in. I'd never heard a roar of people like that. And it was the feast. And on opening night, it was dramatic, exciting, your very first time there. And I learned a lot that first year. Even though I wasn't even a teenager, I still learned a lot. So we find that we learn through our five senses. Hearing, smell, touch, seeing, and taste. All five are involved in the Feast of Tabernacles. All five contribute to our knowledge, our accumulation of knowledge. So I ask again, coming back from this year's feast, what did you bring with you? What have you added to your list or to your gathering, your collection of knowledge? What did you add this year? Now, yours may be different from mine. I'm sure it probably is. But before I'm done today, I'd like to give you certain things that we should all have brought back from this year's feast. Some lessons or some knowledge that I think is critical that we left the feast bringing it with us. You didn't learn it for the first time probably, but I hope you didn't miss it. And to make sure you didn't miss it, I want to talk about it today. Let's begin in Isaiah chapter 49. And I spoke about this, I spoke four times during the feast, and a couple of times I referred to this because I think it's important that we realize the timetable that God has. When we get to the Feast of Trumpets, you see a shift of focus to some degree. If we consider that the holy days are God's plan of salvation, or the festivals are, for the whole world. But as it says in John 3:16, God so loved the world that God has a plan for every human being. It's not a second chance, it's a full chance for all human beings. And that really becomes evident when you get to the Feast of Trumpets. And I've said this before, that the you come through the first section of God's festivals. And it's interesting, it's a complete package when you really analyze it. The festivals begin with a one-day festival, Passover, followed immediately by a seven-day festival, the Days of Unleavened Bread. And then you have three single-day festivals. And then you have another seven-day festival and a one-day festival. You have a one-day festival that ends the seven and is preceded by immediately by 7 days, separate festivals, just as Passover is a separate festival from unleavened bread. And then you have it begins with a one-day festival immediately followed by 7 days. And then the three in the middle. Well, the three in the middle, trumpets is exactly in the middle. It's number four. So you go from Pentecost when the sealing of the first fruits. It's not the resurrection. It's the sealing of the first fruits. You don't have the resurrection until after the trumpets, which is the Feast of Trumpets. So the first fruits are sealed. We now have to endure, we now have to learn and grow as God's people to be in His kingdom. Then you come to trumpets, and trumpets actually affects both. It's on trumpets that the people of God receive salvation. Receive salvation. That is, they become spirit beings. Those who are alive and are changed, those who are dead and resurrected. But on that same day, not only do we see the completion of that part of God's plan for His people, But we see the beginning of God's plan to save the world. So, and again, it's just a term I've used. The God's plan of salvation pivots from the church to the world on that day. And the rest of the holy days pertain to, or the festivals, pertain to the salvation of the world. Every single human being a part of that process, leading up to the last great day and the judgment of all mankind. So that's God's plan. But look at Isaiah 49, verse 6. Indeed, he says, it is too small a thing that you should be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. In other words, this isn't God's total purpose. It isn't just Israel. It says it's too small a thing for you to be my servant just to raise up Jacob and Israel. He says, to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also give you as a light to the Gentiles, that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. So we have salvation offered to the world. That begins with the return of Christ and then the millennium. That's when that begins. We're told in 1 Timothy 2 and that God will finish the work he's been doing. And 2 Peter 3 that he desires for all to come to repentance and to be a part. God did not create man to fail. Therefore, every human being will have an opportunity for salvation, and God's plan has everyone in it. So when we come to the Feast of Tabernacles in the last great day, we are celebrating God's offer of salvation to the world. Now, we say today, which is true, that God is not saving the world today. We are responsible for preaching the gospel to the world, but God is the one who must call. Therefore, we are not responsible, as some people look at responsibility, for the saving of the whole world. Therefore, if we have 100 people at the feast, that's fine. If that's how many God has called. Or if we have 100,000 at the feast, if that's how many God has called. It's important that we recognize that it drives our mission today. It drives our mission today. That God is not setting out to save the world today. We relive that story every year through the festivals. And we're reminded that God is working with us today through his Holy Spirit, but he will work with the world in a time yet future. That is something that is not seen in the world. I've told this story before, but the differences in the Church of God Seventh Day that Mr. Armstrong was associated with were several. The three primary ones were they did not accept the holy days, they did not accept the prophetic understanding of U.S. and Britain, and they do not accept, which makes sense. If you don't believe in the festivals, then you have a problem with a second resurrection. They believe this is the only day of salvation. And so does virtually everyone else. Now, they don't say it very often, but that's what they believe. This is the only day of salvation. If you don't accept Jesus Christ today. So they're very busy, and it's not that this is a bad thing, you know, giving out Bibles, trying to, you know, sending missionaries all over the world and doing all of these things, because this is the only day of salvation. But it isn't true. If you think this is the only day of salvation, then you've got a real serious problem. Because you better be converting the Chinese, the Indians, and you name whatever group of people it is. But that's not happening. And it won't happen. There are 1 billion Hindus in India. And they're not going to change from Hinduism. That is what they believe. Well, based upon the religious conviction or beliefs of Christianity, they're lost. They're finished. They will not have salvation. Because they're not going to change in this lifetime. The only way they're going to change is for something else to change. And that's why God's plan has that as well. And the Feast of Tabernacles is the centerpiece of God's plan. The Feast of Tabernacles provides for or pictures the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ on earth. That's identified in Revelation 5 and also Revelation 20. In Revelation 20, the 1,000 years is mentioned 6 times. But you realize this, that of all the prophecies in the Bible, the Old Testament, all of those prophecies, all of the picturing of Christ ruling on this earth, not a single one mentions 1,000 years. If we didn't have the book of Revelation, we'd be left with, yes, Christ is going to come, yes, Christ is going to rule, but how long before new heavens and new earth? Revelation explains that to us, and John is very, very clear that it's 1,000 years. It's temporary, or it's a temporary period of time. It's a time that begins and ends. The Feast of Tabernacles is, in that sense, temporary. It's 7 days. And no matter how much we enjoyed it, and sometimes I would like to go back to some of the Old Testament examples where they kept it an extra 7 days, but we're not going to do that. We're just going to pretend that today is a part of the feast. Please bear with me in my senility. I know I left the feast, but I want to pretend I haven't. But this year, what did you learn that has the potential of changing your life? Well, there are 3 unique lessons taught each year through the feast, and you need to be sure you didn't miss these 3. I hope you have others. I hope you learned other things to add to your knowledge, to your pool of information that will help change you going forward. But there are 3 that you cannot afford to miss. If you miss these 3, then you, I guess we could speak in terms of how much you may have missed these 3, but if you miss these 3 completely, then you, your feast was a failure, in my opinion. You may have had a good time, you may have enjoyed people, but if you miss these 3 lessons, then your feast was not what it should have been. And I hope you saw them. And if you did not see them or understand them, then I hope to pass them on to you today. There's no other festival, no other holy day, as I said, that comes close to the Feast of Tabernacles in detail, in Scripture even, and what we can expect from it or what we should expect from it. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 23. You notice that there are specific instructions given for the Feast of Tabernacles, more so than any other festival. I mentioned this in the opening message that Mr. Armstrong was faced with a dilemma. He kept the holy days, kept the festivals, but how do you keep them? When he read Leviticus 23, also Deuteronomy 14, the scripture was staring him in the face that these days are different and require us to act differently. Why? Well, this brings us to the very first lesson. Let's look at Leviticus 23, verse 33. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it." Well, that's pretty easy. It's a Sabbath day. We keep it that way, the first day. "For 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord. On the 8th day you shall have a holy convocation." So the 8th day, the first day, are both holy days. They're both Sabbaths. So that's pretty simple. The 8th day is referred to in verse 36. It is a sacred assembly, and you shall do no customary work on it. There's something very special about the 8th day. It is separate. It is called a sacred assembly. Heavy, weighty, there's a lot there. And when you think about it, that one day devoted to, some people came up with different statistics during the feast that it's calculated that there have been 107 billion people lives, the last 6,000 years. Could be as many as 150 billion. You take away from that the people that God has called and the saints during that 6,000 years. And then you're still left with, let's say if there were a billion, I don't know that anyone would think it's that high, but you're still left with 99% of the earth's population, all involved in that 8th day. It's a pretty sacred day, a pretty heavy day. The other places use solemn day, but it doesn't mean solemn in the sense of sadness, but solemn in the sense it's weighty. It's got a lot of meaning to it. And there probably isn't another holy day. I mean, all the holy days obviously have great meaning, but there's no other holy day that involves so many people at one time. So many people at one time. Then verse 41, "You shall keep it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. Shall celebrate it in the 7th month." And verse 42, "You shall dwell in booths." Temporary dwelling. Why? Why do you dwell in booths for the 7 days? You also should note that the dwelling in booths was for 7 days, which also points out the eighth day is a separate festival. Normally, in the Jewish practice, on the seventh day, they would either take down their sukkah or they would go back in their home or wherever they were. They were not required to live in it for the eighth day. I'm sure some did. It was just more convenient, but it was required for 7 days. God points out in giving his festivals that these are two separate festivals. That also was unique understanding to Mr. Armstrong. Even the Jews struggled with it, whether it's 7 days or 8 days, although they knew they were to live in booths for 7 days. But why was there an additional day that wasn't connected to the booths? And as one author put it, a Jewish writer said, well, the only thing we can figure is that we had so much fun for 7 days, God said, well, let's keep them for another day. And that's all they could figure. They will openly acknowledge that they have no idea what the eighth day really means. They've declared it Shmini Atzeret, which is a celebration of the Torah. Because they didn't know, they couldn't find anything else connected to it. There's no historical purpose. There's no agricultural purpose. It's just there. Well, Mr. Armstrong, of course, studied that quite a bit. So look at Leviticus 25, verse 23. This is not connected to the feast specifically, but I think the terminology here makes us think of the feast. This is the Jubilee year that was to begin on the Day of Atonement for that year, that 50th year. Verse 23, it says, the land shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. So God owns it all. He requires that we do certain things, but he says he'll be with us during this entire journey that we're on. The Feast of Tabernacles is temporary. Your life is temporary. There are some people this year at the feast who will not be at the feast next year. Life has a way of taking a toll. As you get older, or without even being older, sickness or death that comes. Or people may simply choose not to go back or not to come back to the feast for whatever reason during the course of this year. God owns everything, but for us, these things are all temporary. The feast is temporary. It pictures living in a temporary dwelling. Your life is also temporary. I learned a lot by keeping the feast in the early years by camping in Big Sandy, which everyone, to my knowledge, did. There may have been a few who did not in those years, but we camped. I've mentioned before, we were not a camping family. When you live in the type of housing we lived in, why would you go camping? You could already see the stars through the rafters. So you didn't need to go camping to look up at the stars. They were there already. But we went. We went camping at the feast, as I said, and this is true. I mean, really, as a child, I thought that the church must own U-Haul and Coleman, because everybody had a U-Haul trailer going to the feast, and everybody had a Coleman stove, or, you know, we bought those in advance of going. We bought tents from Coleman, and I assumed this was sort of some subsidiary of the church during those years. And whenever my sister and I were going to the feast, we saw U-Haul trailers. Didn't matter where they were, where they were going, they were going to the feast, as far as we knew, because that's what people did. We saw poverty. You know, in the first years of the church, most of the members were farmers, or many of them were farmers, or they certainly were not the mighty or the wealthy of the world. They were pretty poor. We went to the feast on a whole feast as a family of four for less money than I'm sure I spent for dinner on the night before the last great day. It's just, you know, a different time and a different era. But God's people came to the feast, no matter how difficult it was. In those years, when we returned from the feast, it was standard. I mean, in some years, I remember, of course, I was very young, that there would be 5, 7, 8, 10, 12 individuals who lost their jobs when they went to the feast. And they knew before they left they would not have a job when they returned. But they went to the feast. Those were the year, or in those years, it wasn't really, we didn't have the laws we have today to protect people. It's difficult today. I mean, not impossible. People do lose their jobs. But it's difficult for an employer today in the United States of America to fire someone because of a religious festival. It can be done, but it's very difficult with the laws we have today. So most of you didn't have to worry about losing your job. Again, if some of you did, then obviously we were very sad to hear that. Certainly pray for you that that be resolved. This year, though, was one of the first years I remember that we had two members in Ohio that actually were threatened with losing their jobs. They're teachers, both at the same school. They've been given time off for 12 years, and now suddenly the school says, no, you can't. And if you go, when you come back, you'll lose your job. Well, of course, at least in one member, not only was in contact with the church, but was in contact with a civil rights attorney. And we got a copy of the letter. This attorney wrote the most brilliant and most pointed letter I think I've ever seen on behalf of the church. He's not a part of the church. Telling them, not only are you going to give them the days off, but you're also going to give them back pay because for the last 12 years, you've made them take off without pay. And you're going to pay them their back pay for the last 12 years that you've not paid them during the feast. Now, the school quickly relented because the last sentence said, if this isn't followed through, there will be a lawsuit on your desk when they return. And so the school quickly changed their view of letting them have the time off. I don't know about the back pay. I thought, well, that's a stretch too far. I don't think I would have said that in a letter if I were writing it. But this attorney said, no. He said, they should not penalize you for taking off for the feast. For them to do that is illegal, he said. And he says, we'll get your back pay. So I don't know exactly how that's worked out, but again, those things happened routinely in the earlier years. So what the first lesson that you should have left from the feast with, that's a significant lesson, and that is the concept of temporary. This life is temporary. You lived in a temporary dwelling as a sojourner. You are a sojourner, and you lived in a temporary dwelling during the feast. It was very important to Mr. Armstrong in 1945 when he came to the fact that we need to pack up and go somewhere, because that's how we picture the temporary nature of all of this and the temporary nature. When I say temporary, I mean it's a set period of time of the millennium. If you miss this lesson, you miss something very important. We lived in a tent when I was going to the feast in the early years. It was temporary, at least I hoped it was temporary. I didn't want to live like that much longer. Although I have to admit, the first time we ever stayed in a motel, which was probably after we'd kept the feast for 10 or 12 years at Big Sandy, I felt guilty. I felt guilty, but I got used to it quickly. Somebody else came in and made my bed. It was all made when I came back that night. I could get food delivered to my room. I could, have a TV. You know, we had nothing in campsites. So I got used to it pretty quickly. It isn't that God wants us to be uncomfortable. There's nothing wrong in staying in a nice place. He wants us to know that it's temporary. It is temporary, and your life is temporary. I also heard on the last great day that a longtime minister in United Church of God, died. Mr. John Seforek died on the last day, the last great day. You don't know, is my point. Life can end quickly. Life can end suddenly. We are all temporary, and we are all sojourners. Hebrews 11, verse 13. Makes it very clear. Hebrews 11, verse 13. The proper attitude and approach of a Christian is this. Hebrews 11, verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off. Were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed. They were assured, they embraced, and they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. The first lesson of the Feast of Tabernacles that you dare not miss is the temporary nature. It's 1,000 years. It's a good time. It's a time of peace and prosperity on this earth, but it will come to an end. And of course, it precedes the new heavens and the new earth. So know that you're temporary. Know from the Feast of Tabernacles that certainly even life is temporary. And we all face death. We face the end of life unless Jesus Christ returns before that day. This was probably the last feast. Well, in fact, I would say it was the last feast for some people. One couple, and I don't remember who it was now, told me that they were going to go to the feast this year with, I think it was his mother, or his parents maybe, because he felt this would probably be the last feast they would be able to travel to. And they wanted to spend that last feast as a family. My mother didn't make it to the feast this year, and she hasn't in a couple of years now. I wish I had known when her last feast was. We didn't know that, and that we could have had some time together at a Feast of Tabernacles once again. But you don't know that. You don't know that, but it's temporary. The first lesson that we must not miss from the feast is the idea of temporary dwelling and the idea that life is also temporary. Now let's look at the second lesson. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 14. These are not rocket science. These are things you've heard over and over again. But to me, these are the three most important lessons that you must not miss. You know, there are lessons you can learn on your own by just stumbling onto them or whatever. But there are three lessons, as I said, that you must not miss from the Feast of Tabernacles. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. So this isn't the first tithe. Term second tithe doesn't really appear, but it is a second tithe that is to be used for a festival in which you are required to go somewhere. Verse 24, if the journey is too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, it isn't your home. However, I mean, it may be a few miles away, or who knows, or maybe many miles away, but it's not your home. You're going to a temporary place for a few days. And you pay for it with the money you've saved during the course of the year. Verse 26, you shall spend that money for whatsoever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. The second lesson that you must not miss is the idea of rejoicing. You know, we think in terms of eat, drink, and be merry as a bad thing. And yet for the Feast of Tabernacles, it's a wonderful thing. This year at the Feast of Tabernacles, the people you were with at the feast, the 626 at Branson, the 370 or so in Estes Park, this is the one and only time that that exact group of people will ever be together. It's never going to happen again. I mean, maybe 90% could be together. It'll never be 100%. So the people you sat next to at the feast, the people who were around you at the feast, the people you saw every day at the feast, you will not have a feast with them in the future. This was a unique feast. And it ended so quickly. You know, as I said, 8 days goes by very quickly. Sort of have that love-hate relationship with the last great day. You're sad to see it go. I think most of us can remember days in Big Sandy where it used to be a lot of tears on that last great day. It was emotional for a variety of reasons. I mean, some people probably cried because they were going to miss their friends. Some people for other reasons. Some people because they were going back home to face some difficult trials. It is a very dark, a very violent, and a very evil world that we live in. There is not a lot of happiness. But for 8 days, God commands that we be there and that we be happy, that we rejoice. You know, it seems odd that you have to tell people to rejoice. But when you look at our world today, you realize why. God says to come out of this world and rejoice for this period of time. You are to have fun with the people you are with. You are to enjoy food and drink with the people you are with. And you are to rejoice. It is one of the major lessons of the feast. Learning to rejoice is very important. We learn the real meaning of people, their lives, their stories, by rejoicing with them. And then, of course, it's sad to leave them. And that's a part of the feast as well. So the second lesson that you should have brought back with you is the concept of rejoicing. And bring that home with you. as I said earlier, going back to school after being at the feast, or even coming to church services after the feast. Now, this year is a little different, and so many people are not back, but it just, there's a buzz, there's a happiness, there's a joy. There's so many stories. Even if you didn't have the very best, even if things didn't turn out the way you thought they would, the joy of the feast. The joy of the feast. You know, when we camped at Big Sandy, no one had ever heard of Big Sandy. I had instructors at school that made a big deal out of, well, where have you been, when I would return. And no one had ever heard of Big Sandy. No one had ever heard of the Feast of Tabernacles. So it was hard. It was difficult to go back into the world after the feast. In the early days of the feast, Mr. Armstrong would always give a sermon, or at least make it a part of a sermon, telling us how to go back into the world. We truly felt isolated from the world for those 8 days. We didn't have a TV. We didn't have a radio. We were our own entertainment. In Big Sandy, in the campgrounds, there was music on every corner. There was food cooking in every tent, it seemed, and it was truly great, especially for a child. The only thing you had to do was to avoid those men with the armbands on. And if you could avoid them, you were in good, because they took their jobs very seriously, especially if you were 12 or 13 years old. You felt it, but it was great. It was wonderful. So I hope this year that you took or brought home with you the lesson of rejoicing, and that you actually extend that into your family now that you're home, that your family becomes sort of this island away from this dark world in which there is fun and joy. Joy is, of course, one of the fruits of God's Spirit that we should have, because we have been given so much, so much. Lesson number 3, the final lesson that we should not have left the feast without. Ezekiel chapter 11. Ezekiel chapter 11. The very heart and core of the meaning of the feast is the time of the millennium and the time when God's conversion of the world will begin. Ezekiel 35. How is that going to happen? Now, we heard many fine sermons during the feast about the peace that there will be, how things will be different in the millennium, how we will, we'll be learning and teaching and all that'll go on in the millennium. But it was over and over again mentioned, well, how does that really happen? And it won't happen until this takes place. Isaiah 35, verse 5. I'm sorry, I said Ezekiel 11. That's what I wanted. Ezekiel 11, verse 19. Isaiah 35 comes after that. Ezekiel 11, verse 19. This is what has to happen in order for the millennium to occur and to be a time of peace and joy and happiness. People's hearts will have to be changed. The way they think will have to be changed. Verse 19 of Ezekiel 11. Then I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within them. Probably my favorite scripture in the Bible is found in the book of Acts, chapter 4. It says there that, referring to that New Testament church, it says the people were of one heart and one soul. You don't have to go any further than that to understand why the New Testament church accomplished all that it did. Unity is a very important principle and a very important thing in order to be able to have accomplishments. A united effort. And you can only have that if it comes from the heart. It says, I will give them one heart, and I will put a new spirit within them, and take the stony heart out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my judgments and do them, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. This is why the millennium will be different. This is why the millennium will be very, very different. As people are converted, one generation, and the next generation, and the next generation during the 1,000 years. The idea of a millennium and a better world coming is the third lesson of the Feast of Tabernacles that you must not leave behind. You must bring home with you. William Miller was a Baptist minister from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. He studied the Bible, and he came up with a conclusion, and this would be in the 1830s, or 1820s actually, when he started, that Jesus Christ was going to return on a specific date. He based that prophecy upon a prophecy in Daniel, and the day's prophecy that's listed there, one of the prophecies there. And he concluded it was going to be in 1844. The first date he picked was in error. Nothing happened. Then he picked a date later in the year, which happened to be, I believe, at least if it wasn't on the holy day, it was near a holy day. And I think this had something to do with his reasoning, although I don't seem to remember now. People literally by the thousands. William Miller spoke to thousands of people across New England at a time when you had no mass media. The crowds began to grow. People came to hear him. 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, and all up in the Northeast. In fact, there was a young girl that came to listen to him, and she was 16 years old. She became very important later on in the Adventist movement. Her name was Ellen Gould, later on to become Ellen G. White. She first heard William Miller when she was 16. And she was enthralled, as many other people were. So on the date that Christ was going to return, or supposed to return, it's noted that thousands of people dressed in white robes and went out on the hillsides with their arms uplifted, waiting to see Jesus Christ. It's called the Great Disappointment in Adventist literature. But out of that came the Adventist movement. But William Miller was distraught and destroyed, and many people were as well. There is no future. Christ isn't coming back. It didn't happen. And you can imagine the disillusionment that occurred. We believe that Christ is coming back. We don't believe or accept individuals that have set specific dates. We believe he is coming back. Look at Isaiah 35. And when he does come back, things are going to change. This is what we believe. This is what we teach. This is what we look forward to. Isaiah 35, verse 5. This is what Christ is going to do in the world tomorrow. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened. I've never been blind, so I don't know what it feels like to live in darkness all the time. I've known people who were blind, and while most of them that I knew handled it fairly well, I can only imagine what it would be like to live in a world of darkness, and then to one day be given your sight back, or to have your sight. The eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. This is the world tomorrow that we believe in. This is the millennium that we look forward to. The third lesson from the feast this year is the lesson of the future. What is coming in the future, we believe with all our hearts. We're committed to it. We preach about it. We talk about it. And during the Feast of Tabernacles, we live it. We were told years ago, and I still believe it's true today, that we should live. Of course, we should live this like this all the time. But certainly at the Feast of Tabernacles, we should live like we're in the kingdom of God. And I've mentioned this before, that when you're camping in Big Sandy and there are thousands of you around, you get to know people very well. You hear them yell at each other. You watch the kids that are out of control. I mean, you know it all. You know the people you never want to camp by again. And you know the people you love to camp by. We learn about each other in ways. And hopefully, again, in my experience, it was always very, very good. But we're learning about each other. Do we live like we're in the kingdom of God? There are people that struggle in this life. There are people that struggle in the church. There are people that have issues or handicaps that are certainly in the church today. We look forward to the day when all of that will be resolved. The third lesson that you should have brought home with you is about the future and really having a vision of what it will look like and what it will be like in the millennium. The Feast of Tabernacles 2017 is now history. There are three simple lessons, though, that if you missed, I believe that's a very bad thing. They're not complicated, but there are three lessons. Number one, life is temporary. Number two, and we live in temporary dwellings for the 8 days of the feast, for the 7 days and then plus the eighth day. Number two, we need to rejoice in the moment. Enjoy that moment of the feast. And number three, we need to understand and have a clear vision of what the future holds for mankind. I learned about temporary dwellings when I first began camping at the feast. I learned to rejoice when I went to the feast, in spite of circumstances in the world. And this year was extremely difficult. as far as sadness, from the hurricanes to the fires to all of the things that happened to the mass killings in Nevada. It's a very sad world, and we have to be very clear that unless God protects us, that some of us are going to be involved in some of these circumstances. We could have been, any one of us could have been at a concert on a Sunday night when that happened. It's only by God's protection that these things, that we are protected from them. But at times, we're not, for whatever reason. And only God, of course, knows that. But it's a very evil and a very difficult world. But I learned to rejoice in spite of what was going on in the world. And we also know what the future is. Lesson number 3. What the future is for mankind. We believe in John 3, verse 16, not the way the world believes in it, but we believe in it. If you look at verse 17, probably most people have never read verse 17, it talks about God setting his hand to save the world. He didn't say when. The Feast of Tabernacles tells us when, and it's yet future. You know, you can choose to learn at the feast each year. You can choose to add, to accumulate knowledge, just as a child. You know, you're a little older than a child. You've been in the church for a number of years. You've accumulated knowledge. You should have accumulated some more knowledge this year. And that builds one upon another. That's why the feast comes every single year. Everyone will not be at the feast next year that was at the feast this year, for a variety of reasons. If this were your last feast, what did you bring home with you? How about these 3 lessons? How about these things that you really cannot afford to miss? What did you learn that will change your life? Christ is coming. The kingdom will be established here on earth. We confirmed that one more year by completing all 7 of God's festivals one more time. It's a story that the world has no clue about. We know. We began with Passover in the spring, and we ended Thursday with the last great day. God's plan for mankind is complete for one more year. I hope it was your best feast ever. I really do. I sincerely hope it was your best feast ever. This next year, there will be challenges. Challenges for the church. It will be one of the more exciting years, maybe the most exciting year. It'll also be a challenging year. We plan to expand the preaching of the gospel. A year ago, at both Orange Beach and San Diego, we met 5 families that were brand new. Brand new. This year I was told a story that I found extremely interesting. A lady from Missouri told me that she's a school teacher, and she teaches in a private school, and one of the things she's teaching are the 5, I think she said the 5 religions, major religions of the world. And she said they start out with Christianity, and she tells them the Bible will be there. You know, they're going to look into the Bible. And again, this is a private school, not a public school. They're going to look into the Bible. And she gave them their first assignment, she told me, before the feast. They've been talking about Israel and Judah, and she explained to them, that the Jews and the Israelites became 2 different nations. And she said, and the 10 tribes of Israel disappeared. She said, I want you to write a paper, this is before the feast, and find out where those tribes went. Where are they today? And so they came back with their papers, and one student, a 12-year-old, she said, gave her the paper, and in the paper she identified the U.S. and Britain as Ephraim and Manasseh, or Manasseh and Ephraim, and she identified all the tribes. And she said, well, where did you get this information? She said, well, I found this website called Life, Hope, and Truth. And she said, oh, amazing, that's the church I'm a part of. And he found the answer. We're going to expand the preaching of the gospel. We're going to expand the care for the brethren. We're in the process of hiring new ministers, younger ministers. We actually are hiring a minister who just turned 30. 29 years old, ordained, and 30 will be hired into full-time ministry. Others coming along as well. Those who are needing to retire for health or age will be replaced. We're committed to caring for the brethren. That's a part of our commission, and we plan to do that. We're going to complete a building this next year where we can expand our mailing, expand our studio, and expand our FI classroom. All of that in the next year. There's a lot to do. A lot's happening. It'll be exciting, and it'll also be challenging. But God has given us a wonderful opportunity to do all of these things. And we've now returned from a Feast of Tabernacles and a last great day. I hope it instilled in you an excitement and a commitment to this way of life. We all have a lot to do, personally and collectively. Now, let's get to work.